Experience is a big deal in real estate these days. That is, creating experiences through operations, amenities, placemaking, and other forms of uniqueness and utility. On this episode, experience means all that and more, with a guest whose career experience offers us a view from the highest levels of the public and private sectors.
When you're trying to hire employees and they come into an office experience where they actually are excited to go to the office every day and not the drudgery of going up an elevator, that is a huge motivator for someone to take space and pay a premium.
That's Ray Washburn, who has worked in enough offices to know. Today, he is the CEO of Charter Holdings, a private investment firm headquartered in Dallas, which owns and operates office properties, hotels, and luxury shopping centers. Ray is also the co-founder of the M-Cloud Restaurant Group, which owns dozens of restaurants, and he serves as chairman of the board of Sunoco, the gas and oil company as well. From 2017 to 2020, Ray held Senate-confirmed international advisory roles for the federal government. In short, his vast experience has lessons for all sides of the business world. Coming up, Ray joins us at CBRE's global headquarters in Dallas in front of a live audience for a candid, far-reaching conversation about his work, his investments, his outlook, and insights across the real estate spectrum and beyond. I'm Spencer Levy, and that's right now on The Weekly Take. Welcome to The Weekly Take, and I'm delighted to be back in Dallas, sitting in our corporate headquarters here with several of our senior leaders, our clients, and Ray Washburn. Ray, thanks for coming out.
Good. Thank you for having me.
So, Ray, if you don't mind, just for the benefit of our listeners, can you just tell us who you are and what you do?
Sure. Well, I'm based here in Dallas, and I'm involved in multiple businesses. In the oil and gas business, I'm chairman of Sunoco, the gas stations, which you're very familiar with. I also own restaurant company that has a lot of regional chains. One well-known in Dallas is called Mi Casina. I'm on the board of Red Lobster, which was part of a group that bought it out of bankruptcy last fall after they went broke selling all-you-can-eat shrimp for $20. That was an interesting story. And then in the real estate business, I've got office properties, hotels, and then luxury shopping centers. And notable ones your listeners probably heard of is Highland Park Village in Dallas, Country Club Plaza in Kansas City, Phillips Place in Charlotte, North Carolina, and we own a block in downtown Aspen, Colorado. So those are a few of the more notable things.
You have some of the highest-end luxury retail here in Dallas, Charlotte, Kansas City, and then you also have restaurants. How does that give you a window into what's going on in the market overall, the consumer?
Well, first, what the restaurants do, it shows me how to properly run a shopping center because it's all about the consumer. And when someone shows up, first thing they see is the flowers and the fountains and first thing I tell my kids when they show up at a restaurant that you do is, what are the lights like? What's the temperature like? What's the music like? Are the bathrooms clean? You will determine the experience you're about to have before you even taste the food or even order the food. The same at a luxury shopping center. If you show up and there's trash on the ground, the landscape is dead, you're not going to have a good experience because you're already thinking, what is going on here? And so the restaurants, having those two interconnected as an operating business, really have taught me a lot of how each side needs to operate. Now, the way business is right now on the luxury side, I got a call a few years ago from Charlie Munger, of all things. And he said, Mr. Washburn, I'd like to come see you in Dallas. Would you have time for lunch for me next week? And I said, let me think about it. Yeah, I think I can have lunch with you, Mr. Munger. So what day works for you? And he shows up with an entourage of people, and they come over to my office. And at the time, he's late 80s probably, and he shows up, and he goes, will you show me your shopping center? And sure enough, it was the real Charlie Munger. So we walk around the center, and then we go into one of my restaurants to have lunch. And I said, Mr. Munger, can I ask you why you're here, frankly? And he says, sure. He goes, I'm the largest shareholder of Costco, and I believe this market's going to bifurcate. Now, this is 10, 12 years ago. He says, I think your shoppers are going to be going to Costco for value and high-end luxury, and the middle is just going to get annihilated. And this is way pre-pandemic and all. And he was so right. I mean, that's why he was such a great investor. He actually got out and walked the shopping centers. And he flew from Highland Park Village. He flew to Shops at Bell Harbor in Miami the next day, and then Americana Manhasset on Long Island, Pier Group luxury centers. So that really crystallized in my mind where we needed to be, and that was the highest end because that consumer will spend Last year, our centers were up double digits in luxury sales. A lot of brands have issues and change over designers, but you get enough of them together, we do well.
Mm-hmm. And your this barbell effect.
Yes.
So Charlie Munger identified it 15 years ago.
Absolutely.
But that's sort of how you get to see both ends of the barbell, too. Is that true? Is there this soft middle?
There's a very soft middle. I also own a lot of shopping centers in lower income areas and have tenants like Aldi and Jack in the Box and, you know, auto supply stores, AutoNation, things like that. And they're doing very strong, those centers, because people don't buy on the internet in that demographic typically. And also at the high end, they don't buy on the internet either. You're not going to go buy a $20,000 ball gown on the internet. And at the same time, you want to show up and enjoy that shopping experience. And much like I said earlier, how a shopping center has to be, how do you feel when you arrive? How do you feel at a restaurant when you arrive? The Hermes, Chanel's, Dior's, all those brands, when you show up at their store, you show up, they hand you a glass of champagne and they show you in the salon. People want that experience. So the internet is not hitting the high end, much like at the low end. Most of those people are shopping multiple times a week. They're not doing weekly shopping. They're doing daily shopping because that's a lot of how they get paid. And so they're not buying on the internet. Plus, they don't want things stolen at their doorsteps and things. So on those ends, yes, you hit the middle ground, the Gaps of the world, Banana Republics. Gap in Dallas, I think, used to have like 20 stores. They're down to like two. And really, the stores in the middle are purely pickup, drop-off, returns. And so that's what's kind of happened. That's why the mall business, the fortress malls like North Park in Dallas or some of the others do extremely well. That's why the middle-income malls are just getting annihilated.
So what do you think happens there? And I would just say that maybe the office, or at least certain segments of office, kind of reminds us of those B malls you just mentioned. Do you see that parallel?
Well, yeah, the problem in office, and I own, unfortunately, a lot of office, is the TI dollars. The cost of a drywall is the exact same in a building you're getting $20 a foot in rent versus the ones you're getting $80 a foot in rent. It's the exact same. And so the TI dollars are eating people alive. And for people who lived in the 80s and saw these beautiful buildings being built, which still on the outside look great, but the inside are just falling apart. Elevators, HVAC systems, you'd go on and on. The parking garages. You know, what people don't realize, parking garages in older era buildings, they don't have the floor weight to hold electric cars. So these electric cars are much, much heavier than normal cars. So a lot of garages in these suburban office parks are going to be all teardowns because they can't hold the weight of cars. And a lot of people aren't factoring the inefficiencies are really what's happened to a lot of this product. So,
well, 2 points there. First of all, when I look at today's office market, mm-hmm. I've said that I do see this like the early 1990s, because after the changes in the tax law in 87, we had all these see-through buildings everywhere, excess office supply, and you can buy a lot of these for a song. But the market is obviously very different today, and markets evolve, not as much people that are buying these things in secondary markets. But the broader point I want to make is this. Is the opportunity today in office the same or different than it was in the early 1990s?
Well, forget. In the early 1990s, those are brand new buildings. All you had to do was finish space out.
Yeah.
Today, you got to redo bathrooms. You got to do, like I said, elevators, the mechanical systems, and all that is totally shot. The other thing that's interesting today is you look at the office parks from the 90s that were, it used to be you'd buy a piece of land and you'd put 10 office buildings out there, no walkability. What tenants want today is a walkability. And so the newer office buildings that you can walk to restaurants, and that's what the new tenants want. And so these suburban office parks that have just a 200,000-foot office building with a 600-car parking garage, tenants just, there's no demand for that anymore. And so these buildings really, I mean, they're going to be teardowns, literally teardowns.
So I was in Miami a couple of weeks ago at the Mandarin Oriental, beautiful hotel, 25 years old. And they're tearing it down. Why? They're going to build a new Mandarin Oriental, and they're also going to put up 200 units starting at $5 million a piece. But I think it speaks exactly to what we're saying here, Ray. A lot of people in this room and elsewhere might say, we're going to convert all these buildings. I'm not convinced. I've met with everybody, as I'm sure you have as well, that the conversion costs are too high. The construction of these buildings is too antiquated. Is it going to be more demolition?
It's going to be a lot of demolition, yes. So especially the talk that you gave in D.C. a few weeks ago I was at, and we listened to these people who built these beautiful AAA, brand-new buildings, and they're going on and on how they, you know, they're fighting tenants off from leasing space. Mm-hmm. And my question to you is, well, why don't we get somebody up here with a suburban building outside of Indianapolis or someone with a suburban building outside of Atlanta or Dallas or elsewhere? those buildings are just, they're impossible to financially, you know, to make work. And there's not much demand for them. And the ones that are, those are the low dollar investors and tenants. And you don't want them to begin with. And I just think it's a train wreck that's happening slowly in front of our eyes.
I want to talk a little bit about Dallas versus some of the other cities in which you invest.
Sure.
If you don't mind me quoting you for some of the articles I've read about some of the challenges downtown has in terms of development. Sure. It may be easy to build, but maybe we haven't always taken the right path. Now, you gave a lot of compliments to One Arts Plaza, but you said some of the building around there, maybe the Arts District wasn't done perfectly, saying, quote, "We've created an architectural petting zoo for the Pritzker Prize-winning architects." Yeah. Is that?
I stand by that. That is correct. Well, I mean, from the outside, you look at them, they won all these awards, but when you let architects take over and they're not true urban planners, you get these beautiful buildings, but with underground parking garages. So what will happen? You'll go to the symphony, you'll park an underground garage, take an elevator or escalator up, go to the concert, get back right in it, and leave. There's no sidewalk presence at all. And so the buildings are spectacular, but there's no restaurants or coffee bars or things like that around for people to hang out. And they needed housing interspersed there, so you get footfall on the sidewalk. So I stand by it.
I think you're talking about sense of place. And this is another thing you suggested. Because I run local restaurants, I'm a big local restaurants fan. So we're trying to rotate older restaurants and bring in local operators that give a sense of place. What does that mean?
Okay, well, if you go to New Orleans, do you want to go to Morton Steakhouse? You want to go to Galatoire's? You know, or if you go to Miami Beach, do you want to go to Joe Stone Crab or do you want to go to a chain? The big thing is what gives cities personalities are the local restaurant scene. And so I was just in Indianapolis in downtown. They had a fantastic St. Elmo's Steakhouse.
By the way, I was there on Monday, and the cocktail sauce is still clearing my sinuses.
That's right. That's right. I bought some to go. It was so great. But you had the personality of that next to a Capital Grill. I mean, there are Capital Grills everywhere. And so what I mean is the cities in the United States, the more they get gentrified with chains and things like that, what's the difference between them? That's why I'm big on promoting. In my Highland Park Village, we have things like Cafe Pacific and Bistro 31. Local operators where the guy's sitting there kissing your wife on the cheek when she walks in, they know your name, you sit down, and you have a unique dining experience. So I'm a big local restaurant guy.
Amen. I always talk about the contrast between credit on one end of the spectrum and cool on the other end of the spectrum. You certainly would like to find both, but you need that mix in order to get people in there.
So as an example, we bought Country Club Plaza this summer. It's, for those that don't know, it's 15 city blocks, million square feet, first shopping center built in the United States. Spectacular property. It had just been run in the ground because it was being run like a mall. And the restaurants, they'd run off the local restaurant scene and they'd brought in restaurants like a Chewy's or a P.F. Chang and Cheesecake Factory and Capital Grill. Well, what's so special about that? People used to drive in from Des Moines or Omaha and spend the weekend at the plaza and shop and go to all the unique restaurants and things. Well, they have all those restaurants in those cities now too. So what is the uniqueness of it? So we're slowly rotating all those out and bringing in the local restaurant scene. And you're right, they don't have credit, and so you kind of have to hold your hand with these people, and a lot of times lenders will say, I don't give you any credit for this local guy who's got this restaurant versus a Darden credit or a big-time credit. It's like, well, you don't understand. That is a minor part of the overall NOI, but it's what actually makes the place.
When we talked about credit versus cool, you think about the banks. And I also think about the banks not just in the context of retail getting a cool tenant. I think about in the office space, about experience. If we want to have an office sector that maybe has shorter-term leases, has more operational versus CapEx. But these are the kind of things I think where the world is changing. I think 1,000 changes post-COVID, but I think the single biggest one is that now experience wins.
We get back to suburban office park where if you lease 10,000 feet on the sixth floor of just your normal, stale, boring office building from the 90s versus one that has a golf simulator and a coffee bar in the first floor, when you're trying to hire employees and they come into an office experience where they actually are excited to go to the office every day and not the drudgery of going up an elevator, that is a huge motivator for someone to take space and pay a premium for it.
Mm-hmm. So in addition to the local restaurants, you were on the board of directors of Red Lobster, mm-hmm. Which recently went through bankruptcy coming out. And that's a old brand, I would say a very well-known brand. How do you turn a brand like Red Lobster into something that is more, I guess, cooler?
Yeah, what's interesting on Red Lobster, we still have, I think it's 650 stores. They closed about 300 during bankruptcy. Its struggles really is in the dense urban areas because you have so many choices of restaurants. But if you go out and you're in Waco, Texas, or you know Peoria, Illinois, and it's there, it's the special occasion restaurant. And people love it because that's where they go for their anniversaries, that's where they go for birthdays. And so really the focus on that is going to be it was started in 1968 by Bill Darden, the Darden Restaurant, and it was the first national casual dining chain that went national, okay, before the other chains came along. And so it's got an incredible kind of love affair with the communities that it's in. But when they went in to just being a box in a parking lot with 10 other restaurants, it wasn't that special. But it's incredibly special in a lot of these markets. And it's responded well since it's come out of bankruptcy and money's been invested back into it. I told you the sense of arrival when I was asked to go on the board. Before I did it, I went out to check out one they have in the Dallas area. And I drove up, and the first thing I saw over the front door, they have this big lobster, you know, big neon lobster at the front. Well, one of the claws had blown off. So I took a picture and sent it to the CEO. I said, look, who wants to go eat at a restaurant where the claw's blown off? So they got that claw fixed really quick. But that was a sense of arrival. You know, it's like, huh, that's not working. I wonder what's going on in the kitchen. So that's the things they're having to go through and reinvest. There's a huge capital program to bring them up back up to great standards. But as far as if you look at Yelp ratings, stuff like that, people love Red Lobster. They just love it. It's just money's got to be invested back into it.
But what's also interesting about that brand, what you're suggesting, there's an expression, does it play in Peoria? Red Lobster may play better in secondary markets than it does in primary markets because it's more of a part of the community. Is that how you would see positioning that brand?
Yeah. I think our highest volume one's on Times Square. And so, I mean, in tourist-driven places, you know, they love Red Lobster. And so it's a great brand. It'll get polished up. It's already had a good turnaround when people realize it's stabilized now and there are no more unit closures. I mean, that's pretty traumatic when it goes to bankruptcy and a bunch of units get closed. But now all the strong, healthy ones are still in place.
Well, let's shift now. You are the chairman of the board of Sunoco, one of the premier oil and gas companies in the world. Tell us about that. Tell us how the oil and gas business is doing.
Well, Sunoco, we have 12,000 points of sale, gas stations, FBOs at airports and things like that. So we sell around 10 billion gallons of gasoline a year, largest independent seller of refined product. And our business is really picking up the refinery. We sold all our refineries off, pick it up the refinery, deliver it to the stations, and make a markup of about 12 cents a gallon. And that's kind of the game. We own about 900 stations. All the rest are jobbers or, you know, franchised out to people. So for us, business is good, but sales with EVs and more efficient cars, gasoline volumes are down a small amount of around 4% or so, but diesel sales, which is really the driver of American commerce, because diesel is really what drives all 18-wheelers, is held up pretty strong. So that is one thing to look at when you're looking at how commerce is doing. They're taking the products from the warehouse to the stores. And diesel sales, that's an interesting thing for your listener to follow.
Well, I think it's very interesting. You have all these leading indicators within your core business.
Yeah.
The restaurant is a leading indicator of the consumer. Sure. The trucks are a leading indicator of internet or just all sales, I suppose, right, commerce-wise. Do you try to put these pieces of the puzzle
sure
together?
Well, I'll tell you, in the restaurant business right now, across all our brands, consumer traffic is flat. It hasn't grown, okay? What has hurt is people aren't ordering as much. So your per check average is down. But what's kind of hiding that is we've all raised prices since the pandemic 20%, mm-hmm, casual dining. So you sit there and look at that number, you go, wow, okay. Your sales are kind of flat. Consumer, customer counts are about what they are. But why? But my sale, it should be up 20%, not flat. Well, what's happening, instead of ordering, you know, nachos, an entree, and three margaritas, you got no nachos, just an entree, and one margarita. And so that's the number to watch. So the consumers are feeling spent right now. Now, take away the high end, which I was talking about earlier with luxury. Mm-hmm. The middle market consumer, credit card debt's at an all-time high. People are still going out. They want to be entertained, but they're just spending less.
Mm-hmm. Speaking of putting the dots together, you were in the prior Trump administration. Just tell us about that.
So I ran an organization called the Overseas Private Investment Corporation. Mm-hmm. And what it did was support U.S. businesses that would want to invest in a foreign country. And we did business in 180 countries around the world. And if you wanted to build a hydroelectric plant in El Salvador, well, it's very difficult to find a bank or someone to finance it for you. So what this organization did, and we made about $1 billion in profit, is a profit making, one of the few government entities that made money. We would take a loan and we could give you political risk insurance. We could cross guarantee a loan and those type things. So it was really a tool of foreign policy and national security. So I spent a lot of time with our different agencies and with the military trying to find really where the Chinese were going. So I went to 36 countries. I was everywhere from Botswana, Vietnam, Argentina, all over where the Chinese were kind of making a play with this Belt and Road Initiative they were doing. The country of Georgia, which is used to be part of the Soviet Union, and where they were trying to make inroads. So I was involved in that. I was on the board of the President's Intelligence Advisory Board, which is the citizens' oversight for all the intelligence agencies, with NSA, CIA, all those. I can't talk much about that, but that was a fascinating thing because I got to see what was going on around the world from that perspective. And then I was on the board of Southern Command of U.S. military based in Miami, and the U.S. military is cut into 5 or 6 command groups. Northern Command is the U.S. and Canada. Southern Command, which I was on, is everything south of the Rio Grande. Central Command is Asia and Central Europe. And then AFCOM is Africa. And then PACCOM is in Pearl Harbor, and that's for the Pacific Command. So the different command groups is the coordinating effect for the military aspects. And the way that came about is during the Grenada. I don't know if you remember that war that Reagan had. Is we went in there and there was no way for all the different groups to talk to each other. You had the Joint Chiefs of Staff, but down on the ground, you know, the Air Force going in the bomb where they weren't talking to the Navy who's bringing ships in. And so what these command groups do is they have one person, they have all the different command groups in there. And so when we have some kind of military action, that they can coordinate all their efforts in one spot. And so that was fascinating to see all the military actions going on in, well, the Western Hemisphere, the southern part.
So I guess...
I had a busy time.
Yeah, so you didn't have much going on.
Yeah, yeah. But all that coordinated together, though, because if we're going to lend money into a country and they're about to get overthrown government, mm-hmm. I needed to know that. And that's how I got from PIAB. And then if we had military action coming in, I had to know that, too. It all kind of worked together.
Mm-hmm. Well, one of the things I've advocated for years, I'm the chairman of the Real Estate Roundtable's research committee, which is why you got to see me the other day, is trying to get more foreign money into the United States. Worked on FIRPTA reform many years ago, which essentially was a 10% exit tax on foreign investors. But now there seems to be pushing in the other direction. And I'm not here to get into the politics of it all, but I will say that foreign investment into the United States has fallen from about 15% of the real estate business down to about 4%. What's your point of view?
Well, you know, it used to be foreign investment was European money. I think the Dutch are the largest owners of real estate in New York City. Yeah, back to the beginning of the United States. And so a lot of foreign money has come in here. It's what built this country. I mean, that's what built the railroads. It's what built so much of the infrastructure. We're floating bonds in Europe to fund U.S. infrastructure. But those were friendly people. The problem today is the Chinese are coming in. They're buying 1,000 acres at the end of the Air Force base's runway and things like that. So that's... There needs to be a lot more understanding of why foreigners are investing in the United States and what they're investing in. I mean, if the Chinese are buying this office building, so what? Well, if it turns out this office building has the Secret Service office in it, or it's across the street from a major U.S. installation of some kind, that's a problem. It's a bigger problem than people know.
As the chairman of Sunoco, I'm sure you have a point of view on this. We track where all the new manufacturing is, where all the new data centers are, and they seem to be following power and water, not just the actual power source, but transmission. But nuclear power keeps coming up now as a hot new source. And since you're about my vintage, you'll remember Three Mile Island was a scary three words, but now Microsoft is a big investor in it. What's the future of energy in America? Big question, but in the different components, whether it's oil and gas, nuclear, or otherwise.
Well, if you look at natural gas, okay, if we can get pipelines built, we have enough natural gas to take care of all the problems we've got. We just have got to get it out. Now, in this administration, you know, it's going to open up again. You've seen it. And natural gas is the easiest non-polluting thing you can pull out. And so that's where it's going to go. I think we're kind of seeing that exposed right now.
Let's bring it back to the United States. You have an asset in Kansas City. Mm-hmm. And here's my funny Kansas City story. I may be an expert in nothing. I am an expert in airports. And Kansas City Airport may have been the worst airport in America until recently, mm-hmm. where they put $1.5 billion into it. And I was there the other day. Beautiful. Salt Lake City just did their airport. Nashville just did their airport. Even Albany's putting money into their airport. Tell us, when you're picking a city, Ray, what are some of the key components, infrastructure or otherwise, that you say this is essential? Or maybe you went to Kansas City before the airport was done, and you say this is going to get much better after that.
Well, Kansas City, it's very difficult to find 15 city blocks contiguous with a million square feet on it anywhere. Kansas City's a very, very old city, very stable city, and it's got an NFL team, very important. If you're an NFL team, St. Louis doesn't have one. Look at the decline they're on. So I would not go to St. Louis because I just don't see the corporate potential upshot there. And Kansas City has had a way to draw a lot of young people, and that's one thing we surveyed was our kids graduating from college and going to that city, and they are. There's a lot of entrepreneurial, you know, energy in that town. And so we're also in Charlotte, North Carolina. Charlotte's kind of the capital of the Mid-Atlantic region, and it's got so many banks headquartered there. We're very pleased with our property we have there.
Where in Charlotte is it?
It's called Phillips Place. It's down, if you know where South Park Mall is,
yeah.
It's across the street from that. We have a brand new RH, one of their superstores in there, the Restoration Hardware we just did an Hermes deal. We're going to turn that into the luxury center of the Mid-Atlantic, much like the Homburg Village.
What's interesting about Charlotte and Dallas, and again, different cities, but both of them have downtown areas that are struggling a bit, but have these great areas that are doing fantastically well in a new part of town. I happen to be in Charlotte near the ballpark. Is that how you see these cities evolving, where they had these older, more established areas that are going to struggle, maybe old office, maybe not a lot of walkability, talking about the Arts District here, and then people just building in a new place? Or do you see a revitalization coming anytime soon for these downtown areas?
Well, kids want, when they get out of school, they all want to live in urban areas. You know, it's not so much as, I'm going to go rent an apartment out on the freeway somewhere. They want to be where the action is. And companies to try to recruit those type of people need to be where their employee base is. So the urban areas, in Kansas City has done a good job. They have, I don't know, 20,000 people living downtown now. You know, these old buildings. It's just the old building stock is pretty much built out now, the easy ones. Now the key thing is, how do you take a 50-story, million-square-foot downtown 1980s-era office tower with 25,000-foot floor plates, with a garage that's separated? I mean, how do you turn those into apartments? And so, I mean, I look in Dallas, and Dallas has a street called Ross Avenue. Everything north of Ross, great. You go one block south, you're not paying 25% of what you're paying. Literally, you could hit a 9-iron and hit that building, but you go the other way, and it's because there are these 80-era buildings that you just can't convert, because a million-square-foot building, I mean, that ends up being 1,000 units, 1,200 units. I mean, you just can't swallow that.
Mm-hmm. And these buildings that are in northern Dallas or buildings that are in the better parts of town in other cities, and I think you're going to see that in cities, that for the best submarkets, people are going to be price insensitive. You agree with that?
That's right. I totally agree. We're building a project, actually, CBRE is we're partners with, or Trammell Crow Company, actually. And yeah. I mean, we're getting rents well over $80 a square foot, whereas you can go literally not 2 miles away on Central Expressway and lease all the space you want for high teens a foot. And from these 80-era type buildings. So, I mean, that's the bifurcation. It's kind of like Charlie Munger deal again. You got the highest quality. The problem in the lowest quality is you have to spend money to maintain it, and it just doesn't make any economic sense to do that.
So, Ray, in building these new buildings today, the office in particular, what's the difference between the amenities that you might put in today's building versus what you might have built 20, 25 years ago?
Well, 20, 25 years ago, there were really no amenities in a building. I mean, you had bathrooms. That's about the biggest amenity you get. I mean, today, you walk in, people that have dumped money into these 80-era buildings, I mean, you walk in, they had the coffee bar, like I was saying earlier, at the front, the golf simulator, which no one ever uses, but it looks great on the tour.
Yeah.
You got to have the big weight room, you know, all those things, which no one would ever dream of putting that in the past. Mm-hmm. Valet, dry cleaning, pickup. It's a concert. It's almost like these buildings need to be run like a hotel, and where they're taking care of people, because people really value, since the pandemic, people value their time so much. They're like, I'll pay any kind of premium so I don't have to spend my time to go do that.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think we have a valet in this building right downstairs, and it's a big deal.
Yeah.
I mean, think about how much time that saves you. 15 minutes on each end. Think about the safety issue. Think about the weather issue for something like that. But that really goes right back to what we're talking about before. Each of these amenities, while there might be some physical amenities, they're really experience amenities. It's like, I want my experience to be better, because most people don't necessarily need to be here. Well, you want them to want to be here.
Well, let's go back to that as far as the restaurants go in an office building.
Yeah.
You can go get your normal chain steakhouse to go into an office building. Not that big deal, not that unique. But getting something unique in the base of a building helps you rent the rest of the building up. Now, your lender might say, well, you don't have great credit on these people. If the guy's a great operator, he might not have a great balance sheet, but he's a great operator. You know he's showing up every day to run his restaurant. That gives that building the unique spin that it has versus just another Me Too office tower.
Should we try to maintain more local flavor when we're thinking about office, not just restaurants?
You're talking about his interior design?
Interior design, the design of the building. Because the buildings often, interior and exterior, look very similar from city to city. Is that the way we should go, or should we try to maintain more local flavor?
Well, I like the local flavor, but you know, when Philip Johnson was in his heyday of designing buildings in Houston and different places that were unique, today these buildings, I agree, all are blue glass and just kind of the same boring exterior look. But you do get a premium for the Starkitect type building, which unfortunately a lot of developers don't want to spend that extra money for it.
Mm-hmm. When you say Starkitect, like a star architect,
yeah,
building it to the whatever the highest, coolest standards are.
Yeah, yeah, that's right.
And you go to New York City right now, you take a look at the case study everybody uses, One Vanderbilt, which is right next to our offices at 200 Park. They're getting rents over $300 a foot there. And across the street, there's older buildings you probably could get rents for $50 a foot.
Yeah. Well, when you're recruiting or you're competing with your peer group and they're in that nice building, you're in the dump, I mean, there's a little ego in there too, I'm sure.
So. I'm sure there is. Yeah. So you're also—
But that building too, built that observation deck on top. And I think that observation deck throws off, I mean, tens of millions of dollars a year in income, which that was kind of an afterthought a little bit to put that up there and they weren't sure it was going to work. I mean, you capitalize that. It's like the Empire State Building, the rooftop. There are other areas you can generate a lot of money in these office buildings that aren't something you normally think of in an office building.
So I'm in a room here of not only great real estate professionals, but people who love your restaurants. And I would be so remiss if I didn't ask you the question of what is your favorite at your restaurants, the Mi Cocina? Is it the Mambo Taxi? And what is the Mambo Taxi or the brisket tacos?
Well, Mambo Taxi is our signature margarita with our own formula. It has a swirl of sangria in it, and it's kind of our legendary drink. We sell, like, Saturday was a great day. I bet we sold, I don't know, probably 30,000 of them Saturday.
30,000 margaritas.
At our restaurants altogether.
Mm-hmm.
And then on brisket tacos are probably the number one.
Mm-hmm.
Favorite thing.
That's fun, though. I mean, look, it's a business like any other, but it's a fun business.
Yep.
You get to go walk in there.
Well, it's fun when it's working. Mm-hmm. I mean, we've opened some duds, and that's not fun. Yeah. But, no, I've been involved in the restaurant business 35 years, and, I mean, we've had everything from steakhouses. I'm partnering the crew wine bars you see in the airports and all those things, and those go great. The challenge in the restaurant business right now is it is so expensive to build these stores. It used to cost us to build a 5,000-foot store $1.5 million. Now it's $4 to $5 million.
Wow.
And so you're going to see a big pause on, you just can't afford to build. And that's why the boxes are getting so much smaller, even like a Chili's or even Chick-fil-A. I mean, a lot of them are just doing away with even the dining rooms. They're just drive-thrus now. And I've seen a Chick-fil-A deal in Atlanta they built where it's the whole kitchen's on the second floor and the first floor is just four drive-thru lanes and it comes down conveyor belts and they just crank you through the deal and you can't even eat inside. Business has just changed a lot. And for us to build another Mi Cocina, it's so expensive that, I mean, you really have got to have a crosshairs that it's going to be, you know, killer location because it's the expense is so great.
$4 to $5 million, new construction, plus a long-term lease, unless you own the real estate itself.
Yeah, you put it in square footage numbers, it's $600 to $800 a foot to build out a restaurant.
Mm-hmm. And a well-performing restaurant does what kind of sales per year?
Oh, our restaurants are $120,000 to $150,000 a week in sales. So it's, you know, call it $6 to $8 million type. Mm-hmm. But a Chili's, those places are doing $60,000 a week probably, something like that. It was a $3 million, $3.5 million. So you do the math, A $3 million unit should make 15% margins. That's $450,000. You just spent $4 million to build it. What's your return on investment? Not that great. So it's pretty simple math.
And what do you think is the single biggest driver of the cost going up? Is it labor or is it?
No, it's just construction costs, just materials and everything else. But, you know, landlords, of which I am one, okay, I mean, we've driven rents up so high. I mean, Highland Park Village, we're over $400 a foot now. And when I bought it, it was $36. And that was only 15 years ago. So we've gone from 36 to over 400 bucks a foot. It's expensive. Now, your normal strip center, you want to go ground up a strip center out in the suburbs, you know, they're all quoting the mid-40s a foot for, you know, you get a Jersey Mike's paying 40 bucks. I mean, it's tough.
Well, I like that just simplification of what's possible. You bought it 10 years ago, getting 36 bucks. You're getting 400 bucks today. That's what's possible if you do it right. That's what's possible if you're in the right market segment. That's what's possible if you do the right things for the center. Well, Ray, any final thoughts here? First of all, we really appreciate you coming out here. Any final thoughts you would say about retail, about Dallas? Where do you see the next couple of years going?
Well, I would just say the cautious winds ahead, which I do think a recession is coming. We've been around long enough. I mean, I got out of college in 1983. I went to the RTC and I can't believe how long we've gone, probably since 09, of anything that even resembled a recession. And so young people out there that are listening to this that think trees grow to the sky, they don't. And when it stops, it's not going to be pretty. And what's going to stop? We have a $36 trillion federal debt. We've got highest consumer credit card debt of all time. We have construction costs that won't come down. We have inflation that just, I mean, we just got to get things to break somehow. And so anyway, just be prepared, because when it breaks, it'll be ugly for a short period of time, and that's the time to get your greatest opportunity.
Well, like I said, when things are bad, there's great opportunity. You quoted Charlie Munger or quote Warren Buffy. When people are fearful, be greedy. When people are greedy, be fearful. Right now, I think people are more fearful, but they'll be worse during a deeper recession. On behalf of the Weekly Take, what a pleasure to have Ray Washburn, the CEO of Charter Holdings, the chairman of Sunoco, and about a dozen other things. Thank you so much for coming out today, Ray.
Glad to be here. Thank you.
For a deeper dive into Dallas and other related content, please visit our website, cbre.com/theweeklytake. You can check out our archives, subscribe to the show, and drop us a line with a review, with feedback, or with any suggestions for what you might like us to cover on the air. Tune in next week for more, including more from investors and operators who will reveal their views on compelling opportunities and other ideas, including some niche assets that have weathered recent economic cycles and other insights that might surprise you. Thanks for joining us, and we'll see you again soon. I'm Spencer Levy. Be smart, be safe, be well.